Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. A couple of years ago, I talked to this guy, Steve Clark, after he finished dead last in a marathon. It took him 7 hours and 20 minutes. I guess it was pretty clear early on that he wasn't the fastest runner.
I see this guy with a sign that reads, two knee replacements on his back because he's passing in front of me. So I get a little demoralized, but...
But he kept going. He fell so far behind the other runners that for the last long stretch of the race, he was basically just limping ahead of the street sweepers. His friend had told him to take on a mantra.
Hers was something like, my heart is strong, my mind is strong, my body's strong. And I just kept saying to myself, just get there, just don't die. God, don't let me die.
That's pretty much me in every single exercise class I ever take. I'm thinking, don't let me die on this mat, on this bike or treadmill or whatever. I just want to finish because being done is the part that feels good. I exercise because I think I have to stay strong and so I can still tie my shoes when I'm 80. But some people seem to genuinely love exercise. Like this crew here. They are part of the November Project. It's these big group workouts that happen all over the country.
Feel free to jump in. You know, it's free for everybody.
In Philadelphia, they meet early in the morning by the Art Museum, you know, the famous Rocky Steps. About 100 people are running up and down the steps, all sizes, all ages. They stop for push-ups or burpees. They're slapping each other high fives. It's a little bit chaotic. Some people bring their dogs, but it seems like everybody is having a ball. So I ask people, why do you do this?
Mental health for me, anxiety.
Oh, really? It helps?
Yeah, absolutely.
How about you?
Great sense of community and a fun way to start the day.
It feels great.
You know what? It keeps me young. I like working out with people of all different ages from all different parts of the city.
Mood, agility, health, strength, and let's face it, maybe a dose of vanity. On this episode, we explore why we exercise, why we should work out, and how to do it best. Let's start with running. Maybe you like to get on a treadmill and just zone out.
I like the treadmill because it allows for solitary exercise. Yeah, you can put your headphones in, you can close your eyes, and you can just go for it.
Or maybe you prefer to run outside in nature. Either way, it seems like you have to really work hard to become a good runner. But when Jad Slaman looked into running as exercise, he found that we humans are perhaps really born to run.
Who's faster, man or horse? That was the topic of discussion at a hotel in Wales, in this town called...
How do you say that name again? The name of the town?
The town? Llanwrtyd Wells.
It's tiny, a main road surrounded by stone cottages, surrounded by mountains. Only about 800 residents. Mike Thomas is one of them, and he tells me this story.
There was a discussion, a debate, or even an argument in the local hotel between the landlord and the huntsman about whether a man on foot could be quicker than a man on horseback over the very wild terrain of the southern Cambrian mountains.
There are these lush, rolling hills and ridges of green and darker green.
Obviously, the landlord felt a man could outrun a horse because of the difficulty of the terrain, and the huntsman said that no way the horse would win every time, and they decided to put it to the test.
That was in 1980. Today, thousands flock to the town's annual Man versus Horse Marathon. Mike helps organize it. Similar competitions have since sprung up all over. Dan Lieberman ran one in Prescott, Arizona a few years ago. He just started running, and he was worried he would end up breaking a promise.
I have to tell you, I was pretty depressed. I had promised my daughter I would, beat at least one horse. That was my goal.
And yeah, right away, that didn't seem so likely.
Because in the first few miles, the horses quickly pass all the humans. And you think, this is impossible. There's no way I'm ever going to catch up to those horses because they disappear rapidly into the distance.
Dan isn't some Olympic athlete.
And I'm not a great runner. I'm an okay runner, but I'm nobody. I've never won anything. You know, I'm just a middle-aged professor.
A middle-aged Harvard professor of paleoanthropology. Running is actually his focus, the way we've run and why we've come to run that way. The Arizona race is a 22-mile trail run up and over a mountain.
I think there were 41 runners and 53 horses. You know, we all start together. I mean, they start the humans and the horses a little bit. They don't start quite at the same time so that, you know, we don't get trampled by the horses.
In the 40-some years since man first faced horse in Wales, a human has run faster than the fastest horse only twice. Both times were with elite athletes. But remember, Dan didn't promise to beat the fastest horse, just any old horse.
As the morning went on, it got hotter and hotter, and we got up and up and up and up at about mile 19 or so.
He came up on a horse, then he passed it. What happened next, Daniel can't fully explain.
And when I passed that first horse, there was some switch got flicked in my brain that I didn't know even existed. And I just had to beat those horses.
Running downhill, he passed more of them. On the flat, open plain in the final stretch, it was a dead heat between him and two horses. He took the lead, then they took it back. He'd dig deep and catch up. All three were exhausted, 10 legs between them. He approached the finish line and crossed first.
I think I beat all but 13 of the horses, which, you know, made me, I've never been so happy in my entire life.
A particularly fast horse took first place, but Daniel left others in the dust. And really, he shouldn't have been so surprised. He's studied human running for years, so intellectually, he knows us humans are actually among the best distance runners in the world.
We have features that are literally from our heads to our toes that enable humans to be really good runners.
So what is it about our bodies that makes us these really good runners? What's going on? I reached out to David Ruvniak.
I'm a sports medicine physician. I have a special interest in taking care of endurance athletes, especially runners.
He works with the University of Virginia's Speed Clinic. He says, first off, we're natural-born runners.
People have their best running form when they're younger and are kids, and then things kind of go downhill as they get older.
We pick up bad habits over time, and that might not matter if you only run to catch the bus. But for athletes looking for perfection, the Speed Clinic has this advanced treadmill with pressure sensors surrounded by 3D imaging. David isn't all that surprised. Humans, even middle-aged academic-type humans, can beat horses in a long-distance race. He breaks it down for me.
Humans actually have a longer stride than horses, so we get a longer distance per step.
If that doesn't sound right to you, don't think Seabiscuit at full gallop. The stride seems super wide when you think about the gap between the front legs and the back. Instead, think dressage.
And here is the horse that we've been talking about, the 9-year-old.
That weird horse dancing sport where riders have their horses take these elegant steps and skips, usually to music. Look at the space between their two front legs, the space between their two back legs. There's actually not much of a gap.
Horses just have four legs and they have shorter, quicker strides, but you know, the longer stride makes us a little bit more efficient. So, you know, they've done studies and horses can run at 7.7 meters per second, kind of top speed for about 10 minutes, and then they have to slow down to about 5.8 meters per second, whereas elite marathoners can jog at 6 meters per second for hours.
And then there's the way we breathe.
Most running mammals have the cycle of basically you run a step, you take a breath, you run a step, you take a breath.
He says not very efficient.
Whereas humans, we have a wide variety of how we breathe when we run, but typically we're at the 2-to-1 strides to breath ratio.
You can stretch out that breath to stride ratio pretty far enough to sing.
Up in the morning to the rising sun.
Remember this scene from Full Metal Jacket as Marines run in formation? David says it's partly a product of the way we run on two legs, upright. Most animals don't have that going for them. Take the humble cheetah.
They are the fastest mammal on Earth. And for example, when they run, their internal organs all kind of slosh around, and they tend to slam forward against their lungs each breath. So each time their front foot hits the ground, their internal organs hit their lungs, and they force out air out of their lungs.
There's two other really important bits of equipment we have that other animals don't. First, long Achilles tendons.
It's basically a rubber band or a spring. So as we land, it tends to shorten and store up kinetic energy. And then as we start to push off during our running form, it releases that energy and propels us forward.
And then there's our big old butts.
Big gluteus maximuses, so big butts.
We derive an enormous amount of power from our butts. You can feel this in action when you run if you want, but you'll look kind of weird doing it.
I mean, what I would tell people is, you know, put your hand on your butt when you're walking and see if you feel it activating. Most often than not, it's not really firing while you're walking, but when you run, it starts to kick on and stabilize our hips.
There's the arc in our feet that dissipates energy, our big toe that helps anchor and drive, but at least as important as these mechanical advantages is the way we cool off, which is uniquely human and tied to our skin.
One of the most obvious things that makes humans different is that our skin looks very different, right? You can very easily distinguish a human from a chimp.
That's Yana Kambarov. She's a geneticist who focuses on two specific human traits.
Human sweatiness and furlessness.
She's also a big fan of these human against horse distance running competitions.
Have you seen the videos?
I Googled it, yeah. Yeah.
What was your reaction watching it?
Well, I was really proud of, I was really just amazed at it, like, or at our potential. Because, you know, I always imagined that, you know, in the natural world, we just sucked at everything.
We don't have claws or gills. We can't fly.
A horse. Hands down, I have no chance. Turns out, though, I can just keep going. Yeah. So if the race is long enough, you know.
Yana will have a chance. For one, because the horse will get overheated faster than she will. Yana doesn't have any fur getting in the way of airflow to the skin. And she's got a great many of a certain type of sweat gland throughout her skin. Chimps, our close relatives, have them too.
But the density of those glands is 10 times lower in any essentially region of the body than it is in humans. They have the same density of those glands as a macaque, which is a vastly smaller primate.
Macaques are those screechy little things with pink faces. They're only about 20 inches tall. Yana is trying to find the genetic root of our furlessness and our sweatiness. What mutation or mutations where in our history caused what? She says she's actually getting pretty close to figuring it out, but really, we don't know for certain why us humans are the way we are, not just with skin and sweat, but with many of our great running features. Dan, our Harvard paleoanthropologist who is faster than at least some horses, has an idea.
You know, I've spent years trying to think of alternative explanations, and none of them hold any water other than that it has something to do with hunting.
There is a competing hypothesis that our running ability is what's called an emergent phenomenon, that all these running attributes evolved individually for other purposes, and it just turns out when you combine big butts and sweat glands and standing upright, whoa, you get a marathoner just as a lucky bonus. But Dan doesn't buy that.
How did we become carnivores without being able to run, right? And we're not like pythons that, you know, can kill animals with venom, and we can't jump out of trees, you know, and kill things. It's running.
Dan says there's evidence we were somehow killing and eating big animals around 2 million years ago, and we did it without any real technology.
So the bow and arrow was invented like 100,000 years ago. Just putting a point on the end of a spear, like a stone point, that was invented less than 500,000 years ago.
Instead of bow and arrow hunting, he says we had what's called persistence hunting.
So what happens is that you chase the animal, it heats up, and then it hides, and then you have to track it and find it again. If you can find it and start chasing it again before it's cooled down,
you can start to close the distance.
Eventually, you know, over time, and it usually seems to take, you know, at least in the Kalahari, for example, it takes between, you know, 13 to 25 kilometers, it seems, on average. So like a half marathon distance.
There's actually documentary footage of this hunt happening in modern times. At the end, the animal just kind of sits down, completely spent.
It's close to death. Karoe's spear throw now is scarcely more than a symbolic gesture.
That kind of hunting was recently outlawed to protect game, and Dan says he doesn't know of anywhere else where pure persistence hunting is still done. These days, a lot of us actually live pretty sedentary lives. We don't run to survive anymore. So what do we do with this superpower?
I'd probably never ran more than 5 miles in my life until we published that paper, and then I started getting invited to go to marathon conferences. And
he's talking about his first big paper on human running and the adaptations behind it.
And I caught the bug, and since then I've become a really addicted runner.
Dan discovered running, even if it's not to catch our next meal, can be just plain fun.
I've really come to love it, and just it's now part of who I am.
From our big toes to our big butts, running may be a part of who all of us are. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
We're talking about exercise. Why do we do it? I recently went to an event where six of the Apollo astronauts spoke.
I give you Buzz Aldrin.
They were all well over 80, and it was just amazing to see how fit they were, climbing up on stage, walking with ease, sitting up straight. That's how we want to age, right? But often life seems to get in the way. I talked to Tony Reed. He's a sports medicine physician at Temple University.
It's seemingly we wake up one morning, say in our mid-70s, and when we bend down to tie our shoes, we get dizzy and wobbly, or we find that we can't reach our feet anymore to tie the shoes. While it seems like that happened overnight, that's stuff that builds up slowly over time.
After the age of 30, we start to lose lean tissue. The body fat percentage usually rises, muscles atrophy, bones lose some of their minerals and can get weaker. Our balance gets worse. Blood vessels and arteries stiffen. The heart has to work harder. Tony says regular exercise can help reduce or prevent many of these issues.
You know, maintaining your flexibility either through something like yoga, Pilates, Tai Chi, or even just simple core stabilization exercises, where maintaining muscle strength early on and beginning the process early in your 30s, 40s, 50s to be able to maintain that muscle mass and just remaining active. The earlier in life we do all of that, the less likely we are to have that happen suddenly in our mid-70s. But even if you're already in your 60s, even if you're already in your 70s, frankly, even if you're already in your 90s, it's never too late.
So I guess a lot of times when we're younger, we focus on, the beach body for this season and losing a couple of pounds and this and that. But it's really the long game we're playing.
It's a little bit of everything. Yes, there are people out there that focus on the short gain. Those same people are going to have some long-term benefits from that naturally without even being focused there. There are others that focus on purely the long game and not so worried about what they look like in a bathing suit today, but more worried about what they look like alive and healthy in their 60s and 70s.
What's a good plan? If I want to exercise with an eye toward aging well and being strong, being able to tie my shoes, what do I do?
What I'll say now is particularly geared towards the aging and the elderly, but it applies to everyone. Moving more throughout the day and sitting less, 150 minutes of exercise at a minimum per week of moderate intensity exercise. Now, moderate intensity is, if you think about, you know, a 0 to 10 scale of how hard you're working, it's about a 6. It is, I can talk in sentences, maybe short sentences, but I can't sing. You want to spread that over a couple of times a week. You also want to add in strength training at least twice a week, and you want to add in a little bit of flexibility training, flexibility focus daily if you can. Now, the most modern recommendations on that is that you want to do them in at least 10-minute increments. So when you get up and walk, you get up and run, you get up and do whatever exercise you're doing, do it for at least 10 minutes.
What's the importance of weightlifting for women? I hear a lot about that, but I don't see a lot of women in the gym doing the weights, honestly.
Yeah, and it's really important from a calcium perspective. Bone loss happens in women more quickly than it does in men, particularly after menopause. And when you start to have that calcium depletion and that bone loss, you start to get weakness of the bones, more likelihood of broken bones, fractures. Doing the strength training helps replenish the calcium because it causes increased resistance in the bones that causes calcium to come in and lay down. It also makes the muscles stronger to help support the bones more than what they would if they were weaker. And so we see it in both sexes, both men and women, but we see it more in women in part because of the physiologic changes that occur in women.
Getting into the habit of exercising can be challenging. I think I started doing a regular practice of exercising, let's say, 6 or 7 years ago. And still, every day I'm like, oh, do I have to do this? Why do I have to do this? Do I really have to do this? All the time. It's never become something where I'm like, yay, I'm going to exercise. So what helps people like me who really have to drag themselves out there?
Well, and I'll give you an analogy. A lot of people feel that way about work. And I have a feeling that what we do is we equate exercise to work, in that it's not something that we necessarily always want to do. It's something that we have to do. My suggestion to people is always to find the activity that you enjoy. And so we talk about swimming a lot. It's really one of the most recommended activities just because of all the benefits. It's a total body workout. It's a weightless in an environment. Great exercise, unless you hate swimming. Then it becomes work. And in those cases, then I recommend to people that they do cycling or some form of an erg rowing kind of thing. If they don't like those, we move on to something different. And we are always looking for what is it that you enjoy. And there's something out there for everyone. It's just a matter of finding the right one.
And it will pay off.
Absolutely.
Tony Reed is chief medical officer at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia, and he's also a sports medicine physician.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about exercise, why we work out, and why we should. What do you do for exercise? Margie Ferris, a mom of three, likes to punch the heavy bag at Muay Thai class in West Philadelphia. Her four-month-old daughter usually comes along, takes a nap in a carrier nearby. And Margie alternates between rounds of midline kicks and jabs.
Just to get it out at the end of the day and punch stuff feels really good. I like that I can just turn off my brain and let my body go and just, not think, just let my body do what it has to do.
This kind of exercise for women, like kickboxing or CrossFit or weightlifting, even just exercising in a public place, would have been unthinkable not that long ago. Lindsay Lazarski takes a look at the history of women's fitness.
Picture this. It was the 1940s and a new kind of salon was popping up. Not for your hair, but for your body. And luring in women across America.
Girls, it seems that after you helped to win the war, you'll still have another battle on your hands and legs and things. The Battle of the Bulges. And here are some of the latest mechanized units on maneuvers, or rather, womaneuvers.
These places were called reducing salons and figure spas, where contraptions whittled away at women's waistlines or smoothed out those unsightly lumps and dimples.
They're machines, and you see women standing in them in high heels.
That's Natalia Melman Petrozella. She's a self-described gym rat and historian at the New School in New York City.
If you want to look like a sea nymph, you board the streamliner, and away you go to health and happiness. It curves you right.
Natalia's working on a new book about exercise culture in America. She says at the time, exercise was inextricably tied to beauty. Fitness was about how you look, not about what you could do.
they were predicated on the idea that what you wanted to do was, yes, work on your body. So that's something we still have with us today. But the ads all said things like, relax in luxurious comfort, no sweating whatsoever. And the idea was through technology that women could still be ladies and not be like grunting and sweating, ew. And they could relax and have their bodies kind of worked on, basically like passive exercise.
And next to beauty salons, early group fitness classes sprang up, where women did stretching and light circulation exercises. By the 1950s, there was a cultural shift. It was the Cold War. Americans were moving to the suburbs and enjoying modern comforts like big cars, drive-throughs, washing machines, and strollers. But were these new luxuries making Americans chubby or weak?
What JFK called the soft American. The soft American is flabby of body and thus of mind and thus as a citizen. And so you see this big initiative by the federal government, beginning with Eisenhower, but it really picks up with Kennedy, to kind of make exercise normal, make exercise desirable, make exercise be part of being like a full citizen and a full person in a way that it absolutely had not before.
And that included women. In the 1950s, a California bodybuilder capitalized on that moment.
And now, here is the man who will show you how to feel better, look better, Jack LaLanne.
Before Jack LaLanne invented the power juicer or became an infomercial regular, he was known as the godfather of fitness.
Jack LaLanne started like really the first exercise television show, and he funded it out of his own pocket because nobody believed anybody would watch exercise on TV. They were soon very surprised.
Now, how would you like a good movement to help to firm up the thigh right along in here? Huh? Would you? Put your hands on your hips. Now, take your left leg and just extend it right out to the side. Ready? Begin. One, two, three, four, one, two, and three.
One of the things that Jack LaLanne did is that he created an exercise program for women that actually required them to put away whatever they were doing at home, their chores, and to do exercise with him. And that sounds like a minor thing, but it was kind of, I would say, the beginning of like exercise is me time for women. And that's still very much relevant today, that it wasn't just TV they'd watch while they were ironing or washing the dishes, but rather dedicated time for them.
Shows like this ushered in the age of workout videos, DVDs, and fitness gurus who would become celebrities in their own right. And then, by the late 60s, there was a new craze in town, cardio.
The introduction of the idea that cardio was not only a good form of exercise, but that people should be doing this for their heart health, for their appearance, that really changed the game in terms of exercise.
The idea came from Kenneth Cooper. He was a physician and colonel in the Air Force. He coined the term aerobics and wrote a book of the same name that became an international sensation. If you have a Fitbit and are aiming for those 10,000 steps every day, that's Cooper. His book got people to throw on a pair of rubber-soled shoes and jog.
As kind of easy it is to just go outside and go jogging, I don't want to underplay how weird it was. And you see articles, like newspaper articles, talking about like joggers spotted on the street. What should we do about this? And there's like a few towns who want to issue tickets if you're seen jogging, or should you need a permit to go jogging? And so it really did look strange.
Especially for women. But soon another option emerged. Around the same time, a young dance instructor in Chicago noticed something that sparked an idea.
Judy Shepard Massette saw all these women who would watch their daughters have dance class and was like, they could be doing something too.
Judy created Jazzercise, an upbeat workout that mixes dance and aerobics with a lot of spunk.
You gotta get up and boogie with this, honey. Yeah. You gotta find that boogie body.
Yup, think spandex, leotards, and leg warmers. After all, exercise was supposed to be fun, right?
Now take it to the right, the left, the right.
She moves out to Southern California, a very body-conscious place where there already was a kind of health and wellness culture percolating in the 1970s. And then from there on out, her big turning point is she decides to franchise the business. And she had a lot of military wives who then got reassigned. They got certified and then started these franchises all over the world. And so there, that kind of spreads.
By the mid-80s, Jazzercise was the second fastest growing franchise in America, behind Domino's Pizza. Under those leotards and leg warmers, a new concept was beginning to surface in women's fitness: empowerment.
Are you ready to do the workout?
For example, Jane Fonda with her workout book.
She found exercise because she had an eating disorder, and it allowed her to finally let go of those disempowering beauty standards and to do something that made her strong and empowered.
And let your heels touch down.
Large muscles in your thighs and hips are forcing greater volumes of blood to your heart, which in turn strengthens the heart muscle. And that's why these exercises are cardiovascular. It's important to keep breathing.
From where we sit today, Jane Fonda may seem like just another Hollywood icon. But at the time, she helped exercise become a part of women's public lives, where it's okay to sweat, and where it might even be viewed as sexy, and where you begin to see
women calling themselves feminists, both rejecting the narrow vision of like what exercise for women is and should be. Like, this is not about reducing yourself away, but they're building on some of the same ideas. Like, yeah, women should work on their bodies. Women should have time for themselves. Women should go to the gym. But they're using those ideas to say, but this is about bodily self-determination. This is about, liberation from those norms rather than about conforming to them. And I think that kicks off a whole like strand of women's exercise, which is still with us today.
Sure, there's still tons of exercise that's geared toward getting that tiny bikini body to slim, firm, and tone. But for many women today, regular exercise is about caring for the body they have now. Like for Margie, the kickboxing mom of three.
I like to push and see what's next, like what can I do? The more I show up and do the work, the stronger and the fitter I can get. And it's really empowering. I love that feeling of being strong, to be able to lift my kids if I have to, plus the groceries, plus all that stuff. You have to remember to keep breathing.
That story was reported by Lindsay Lazarski. I've noticed a shift lately when I'm watching fitness videos or yoga videos in the kind of language the instructors are using. They say stuff like, you look really strong, or feel how hard your muscles are working. They seem to focus on strength rather than looks.
This sequence is all about just getting into your own body, finding your strength within, and remembering that you are self-confident all the time, no matter what obstacle, no matter where you are.
That's yoga instructor Jessamine Stanley. She's really big on body acceptance. The language is changing, but societal concepts of women's bodies and beauty, what we're, quote, supposed to look like, all of that remains really tangled up in exercise for many women. Our next story illustrates that complicated relationship. Exercise changed Marta Rusick's life. It helped her lose weight and feel better. But really accepting her body and herself took a lot more than that. Shai Benyakov caught up with Marta on a walk.
And I usually walk very fast. I'll try to keep in mind that I'm with other people
fine.
Today.
No problem.
Physical activity is a daily thing for Marta now. But that's a somewhat recent change in her life. She struggled with her weight for years.
I started to get heavy about the time of high school. You know, you're surrounded by good things to eat. It's a crutch if something's not going well. It's a support if something is going really great. But by the time I got to college and, you know, now Marta, you're on your own, I had access to all this food.
Pizza, tacos, snacks, sweets. Food was a reward and a crutch to get through tough times. Marta put on more pounds.
How did your weight, do you think, influence interactions that you had with other people?
My confidence took a pretty big hit. So as a consequence, I really didn't start dating until long after I'd gotten out of college. I'd always had guy friends and...
So Marta wasn't feeling great about herself. Plus,
I started to get a pain in my side, and we suspected that it might be kidney stones. And someone had said, you know, common causes of or common characteristics of somebody that has kidney stones, women usually get them. It's women over 40 and women who are overweight. So fat, female, 40. And I had two out of the three, which didn't bode well.
She never confirmed the kidney stones, but at 218 pounds, she knew something should change. It had to change.
I don't like working out.
Marta is also a lifelong asthma sufferer, which didn't help.
My mother would always say, you know, my daughter has asthma. She really shouldn't be engaged in physical activity. I don't want her to, you know, get overrun, and I don't want her to, you know, get overexcited.
But Marta, determined to do something about her weight, dusted off a recumbent bike from the basement, got on, and started pedaling. How do you feel, like, at the end of 15 minutes, that first week or so?
I wanted to die that first day. It's just like, my heart is like, why are you doing this to me? I thought we were friends.
Change came slowly, and Marta wasn't even the first to notice it.
Definitely other people were the ones to let me know, hey, there's something different here. And what's nice is in the beginning it was, are you doing okay? Are you sick? Is something wrong? They didn't realize, well, I've taken the initiative and decided that I don't want to be 218 pounds anymore.
So first they asked if you were doing okay. Mm-hmm. And then there were some more positive kinds of comments.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, you look really good. Have you done something different with your hair? People were more free with the comments once they realized, oh, this isn't like a serious illness that's causing you to lose the weight. This was a definite choice. I think they felt more comfortable to say, well, in that case, oh my goodness, you look so good.
Marta joined a gym and started to up her effort. And as she did that, she started to get compliments.
Hey, you look really good.
So she put in more time and got noticed.
Have you done something different with your hair?
More effort. More compliments.
Oh my goodness, you look so good.
Marta took up spin, slowly at first, but she got better and better. Her asthma disappeared. She wasn't just losing weight. She was becoming an athlete.
There was definitely more muscle tone. I became a lot more flexible, which was great.
And at the same time that this was going on, you were changing your diet also.
Exactly.
Right.
Because you're only as good as the food that you're putting in.
So you were counting calories?
Yeah.
At this point, Marta was a completely different person from when she started. She was thin, buff, and flexible. She'd gone from a size 16 to...
I was pretty small. I think I was a size 4 at my smallest.
That's when things got weird. When do the catcalls start?
The catcalls started, you know, small enough. You know, I used to work for the Apple store, and, you know, the guys that were working around me, wow, she looks really good. Like, you'd overhear people, and you'd like, wow, she's changed a lot. But then it started to become catcalls, like people on the bus, people walking around the city.
Would you mind just kind of telling me some of the comments that you got from people?
Back that thing up, you know, looking good, baby, things of that nature. And, you know, I like a teeny waist. Yeah, those are the milder ones. I've heard ones that I definitely wouldn't want to repeat on the airwaves.
How'd you feel? Like, how did that, you know, this is a very different kind of feedback than you were getting at first.
At first, you're kind of like, oh, wow, strangers on the street are telling me I look good. I must be doing something right. But as a feminist, you kind of wonder later on, well, what was wrong with me before? Was I not beautiful? Was I not worthy of your attention when I was 218 pounds? Because what was wrong with me before that, you know, when I got on a septa bus at 218 pounds, you know, you were happy to say, move your fat ass.
Eventually, Marta joined the Peace Corps and spent a year in the Gambia. There, food was about joy and community. But she realized that keeping a diet would be a challenge.
There's either a lot of bread, a lot of different grains, or there's a lot of rice. So that was tough because that was a huge way to build community, was to eat several meals a day with your family. If you were traveling, people would say, oh, come and eat with us. So, you know, I always had a spoon in my bag for those occasions so that I could just chow down wherever I went.
Her stay in Africa and her experiences there transformed Marta's relationship with food.
It wasn't just about, I'm going to splurge and have a slice of cheesecake. It was about, I'm going to go enjoy a meal with my friends. It was definitely more of a bonding experience. And it was a relationship that was transformed.
And her attitude toward fitness and her body has changed too. It's no longer about what other people say to her or think of her.
Last week when I was in North Carolina, I met a woman named Ruby. And she gave me this affirmation that she says, I want you to just say this to yourself at least once a day. You know, when you wake up in the morning, when you go to sleep at night, I am totally and absolutely in love with myself. And that's really what it's become about. There are always going to be people who say, you're not good enough, or you could have taken that further. You could have put in 15 more minutes of working out. but it really doesn't matter. I don't answer to any of those people. At the end of the day, it's about I am totally and unbelievably in love with myself.
That story was reported by Shai Binyako. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about exercise, why we work out, why we should. Remember gym class?
All right, ladies, let's pick teams for dodgeball. Connie, would you like to be a captain?
Sure. I pick everyone except Meg.
Fair enough. Go!
Ow, 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 ow!
All right, that's from Family Guy, but a lot of people have somewhat similar memories of gym class. We asked about this online, and here are some of the things we heard back. Lee Goldenberg told us about doing gymnastics in fifth grade.
And our teachers rolled out mats and put us all in lines and said, okay, the first thing we're going to do are cartwheels. I felt pretty confident in my abilities, and so I went first, and I did my very best cartwheel. Immediately, the teacher announced to the whole class, Lee just demonstrated a great baby cartwheel. So if you can't do a regular cartwheel, just do a baby cartwheel. That's fine, too. I think that was the last time I ever attempted a cartwheel.
My name is Aruni Jayatilaka, and I am recording my memory of gym class.
Aruni was in a new school in seventh grade playing handball. Somebody passed her the ball for the first time ever.
In team handball, you either have to pass the ball to someone else or dribble it. But I was so excited to have gotten the ball that I just grabbed it and ran all the way down to the other end of the gym. I was only dimly aware that all the other kids had stopped running and were back on the other side staring at me.
Aruni says that was the last time anybody ever passed her the ball in any game. Bad phys ed classes can make students dislike school altogether. They can leave a lasting impression that makes people less physically active. So there's actually a lot riding on gym classes. Alan Yu reports that some teachers are trying to make them better.
When Aisha Sultan was in school, she hated gym class, and she particularly disliked running outside.
Because it was such a forced activity, and sometimes we had to do it as punishment. If somebody had done something wrong or the teacher was just like in a bad mood, we would be out there running laps.
Outside, in the heat, in Texas.
I was never good at any sports, and it led me to believe that I was not athletic and terrible at physical activity.
But she's always been physically active. She likes hiking and took dance and cardio classes in college. She's now a columnist based at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And in 2014, almost 20 years after her last gym class, she did what she hated in school. She ran outside.
I was able to run half marathons and I ran a marathon. But you would never have known that if you had seen me in my misery in gym class.
Aisha stayed physically active despite her negative experiences of gym class, but the research shows not everyone does that. A study of more than 1,000 people across the US found that bad memories of gym class, especially memories of not being chosen first for teams, could be linked to being less physically active as adults. In other words, the effects of gym class stay with you. And when we talk about gym class, there is one activity that has become the defining trope.
Behind the white line. When everybody...
I'm standing safely to the side of a dodgeball game at Constitution High School in Philadelphia. The students hurl the balls at each other hard and fast. They jump, sidestep, and bounce on their feet the whole time to avoid getting hit. The players are very into this.
Most people say it's not their favorite subject, but it's definitely mine.
Tymir Felton is a senior. He's tall, fast, and if you're playing dodgeball, you want him on your team.
I'm kind of like an exercise freak, like staying fit, you know, staying in shape. But gym is how I do that when I don't get a chance to work out.
He plays football, basketball, volleyball, runs track and cross country, and works out 5 days a week. And that's the issue critics of physical education class point to. It's great if you're already fit and good at whatever the class is about. But not everyone starts out that way. Here's Andrew Rowan, a high school senior at Morristown Friends School.
I'm not the most athletic student.
of the bunch, and you've got these star basketball players who are actually on the varsity high school basketball team, and then like me and some of my friends who are like struggling to not get knocked over as people are dunking on the basket.
And if PE class just reinforces existing differences, the athletic kids get better and everyone else is embarrassed or miserable. Robert Moore, the PE teacher at Constitution High School, knows this. So sometimes he lets the students choose what they want as long as they fulfill the goal of the class.
Sometimes we're doing our cardio day, we do steps. We do the steps up from the basement to the sixth floor, up and down for 15 minutes. Some kids could be walking, doing stairs, doing cardio, jumping rope. As long as you're doing something active, you get an A for the day.
And he's open to taking a back seat and letting a student lead the class.
I have a girl in one of my classes. She's really into yoga. She has all the stretches and all the poses, and I let her kind of dictate, and the rest of the class jumps in and they're participating and trying their best.
And for Robert, that's the point of gym class.
Trying to get them more active is the idea, and trying to get kids who do lead an active lifestyle to find things that they continue to do and have fun doing into college and beyond.
PE teachers nationwide are trying to pull off this reinvention of gym class. Michelle Carter is the senior program manager at Shape America, a professional group for health and PE teachers. She was a PE teacher herself for 6 years, and she knows it will not be easy to change people's minds.
I'd meet up with friends and we would do, go out for dinner or happy hour, and I'd meet other young professionals and, you know, we're sharing, what do you do? And I would tell them that I'm a PE teacher. And I think the most two common things that I did here was like, oh, I couldn't stand PE. Or they would ask me, oh, do you still play dodgeball?
She says if you think about any high school PE teacher in a TV show or movie, that's an example of what not to do.
That's old school PE that we are really trying really hard to change.
There are no federally mandated standards for PE class, but Michelle says most states adopt the standards from her organization or use something that's very similar. Michelle says her group wants PE teachers to design classes so students can learn at their level. Maybe the star basketball players can play basketball, or the kids who need to learn simply how to pass and catch a ball can do that. She says the whole point is for students to learn skills, running, jumping, throwing, catching, so they can find a physical activity that they like and will do to stay active as adults. Also, Michelle says students should not have to stress about getting picked for teams and where they stand in the social hierarchy.
Find someone who is wearing the same color shirt as you, or find someone whose birthday is in the same month. Find someone whose name starts with the same letter. So it's not friends trying to get with friends or people feeling left out, but it's something that's more random and allows for different people to work together.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. And here is one more bad gym class memory. This one comes from Helen Ubinas.
So I'm maybe 12, mad, awkward, with a crush on Steven Martinez, class heartthrob. The gym teacher calls dodgeball, where I struggle to get his attention but not get tagged. Steven Martinez clocks me straight in the face and my nose starts bleeding. Kids laugh and I learn, love hurts.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lizarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.